face. "Shite," he said, but he gave her a grudging smile all the same. "Well done."
"And you?" She paused. "You think he's out of the running? Mark, I mean."
David shrugged. "For next year, anyway. How's your logbook looking?" he asked. He was referring to the surgical logbook they would all have to submit before September, a record of every surgery they had performed or assisted on over the 6 months of this surgical rotation.
"It's good. Solid."
It was better than solid.
"You?"
David nodded. His expression softened after a minute. He was about to ask her how she was.
"Right, well, I've got to go,"
Aisling said. She stood and put on her coat, shoving her phone into her pocket.
"Me too, shift starting," David said.
Aisling left the hospital without speaking to anyone else. She walked up University Road, joining the flow of students heading into town for a night out. They walked in little groups, chatting, laughing, ignoring the drizzle that left fine droplets on Aisling's hair, on her coat. Their energy was infectious, and she wished for a moment that she were one of them. For the first time since Jack's death, she felt a glow of hope and energy.
She passed. She was kicking arse on her assessments. She wanted pediatric surgery, and it was right there in front of her, waiting for her to take it.
Aisling reached the Keys bar and started to push her way through the crowd. It was busy, but it wasn't heaving yet, though it would be in an hour or so. She made her way to the bar and ordered a Coke, carried it with her as she scanned the place for Maud. She found her at one of the small tables on the narrow mezzanine floor that overlooked the bar. Maud had a notebook open on the table and was writing something. She had a glass of wine beside her, which she'd made some progress on. She looked up as Aisling approached and smiled, pushing out the other chair so Aisling could sit. Defensiveness made Aisling abrupt.
"I looked into the post-mortem results."
"He got the report?"
Aisling nodded. Maud looked as if she expected her to pull the report out of her pocket and hand it over. That wasn't going to happen. Reading it had been difficult enough for her. She wasn't going to inflict those photographs, that horribly specific language, on Jack's sister.
"Through a friend. He broke the rules to get me a copy. We can't tell anyone we've seen it until it's formally released."
She'd asked for a lot of favors recently, for a woman who claimed to be independent.
"What does it say?"
Maud asked. She leaned forward across the table, so eager.
"He had a basilar skull fracture, very severe. It probably would have killed him, but he had aspirated a small amount of water, so the official cause of death is drowning."
"Okay." Maud swallowed, paused. Her pen hovered above her notebook.
"It doesn't give us any answers, Maud. The fracture could have happened as he entered the water. He could have hit his head on the bridge supports on the way down, or on a rock submerged under the water."
"What do you think happened?"
Maud asked.
"I don't know. The fracture was very low, at the base of his skull. I've seen that sort of injury once before. That time it was a golf club to the back of the head. Someone could have hit Jack, could have knocked him unconscious, then dumped his body into the river."
The image of Jack tumbling into the freezing black water came to her, and she pushed it resolutely away.
"But equally, he could have fallen into the water somehow, hit his head on the way down. There's no way to know for sure what happened, at least from the post-mortem."
Aisling looked at the hand she'd placed on top of the table and clenched it into a fist. Surgeons had steady hands.
"It's the shock,"
Maud said. She had noticed.
"That's all. That and exhaustion."
Aisling nodded.
"Did you get his messages?"
"No."
She didn't admit that she'd never asked for them. The way Maud was looking at her, so eager, so intense, made that admission possible.
"Damn,"
Maud said. She paused.
"It's a pity the post-mortem isn't clear, but I think we have enough to go on. I think we need to start escalating things. Make a bit of a splash, go to the press, get some attention. I've already made a few phone calls. Can you do an interview tomorrow?"
She caught the expression on Aisling's face.
"It doesn't have to be tomorrow."
"You've been speaking with journalists?"
"We need to put pressure on the police. Media coverage will do that. They won't be able to brush off a journalist in the same way they can do with you or me. This way we might get somewhere.
What did you tell them? About me? About Jack? Jesus, Maud.
The exhaustion and nausea Aisling had felt earlier in the day burst over her again in a roll of feverish heat.
I haven't said much yet. Just enough to get them interested.
I don't want this. I don't want to do any interviews. I don't want to talk to journalists.
Okay. Some of the animation dropped from Maud's face, and caution took its place.
I can talk to them. You don't have to be involved if you don't want to be.
Aisling shook her head. Christ, it was getting loud in here.
Look, I think we're out of our depth here. I understand. I mean, I get why you want to keep asking questions. But we should bring this stuff to the police. Should trust them to do their job.
The caution on Maud's face changed to something harder. Something like dislike. She stared down at her open notebook, covered in her own handwriting. Slowly, she started to gather up the papers. Aisling put out an impulsive hand to stop her.
Wait, she said.
But when Maud looked up, she found she had nothing to say.
I don't know what makes you think you can trust the police, Maud said. They've made it very clear that they have no interest in investigating Jack's death.
You don't know that, said Aisling. Just because they aren't talking to you, that doesn't mean they aren't doing anything.
Her words rang hollow. Hadn't she told that detective she thought he was full of shit? She didn't even know whose side she was on. And she hadn't told Maud yet about that conversation, about the questions he had asked. Maud pulled her notebook out from underneath Aisling's outstretched hand. She pushed it into the backpack resting at her feet under the table, then straightened.
You want to bury your head in the sand, pretend that none of this is happening? Something rotten, something stinking and fitted has found its way into your life. But you think if you don't look too closely at it, if you turn your other cheek just so, it won't really affect you. It's already taken Jack. You say you loved him, but you're not willing to take the smallest risk to find out who murdered him.
I did love him. We were partners. We shared a life. That's what love is, Maud. It's not a series of dramatic gestures. It's not abandoning a 5-year-old boy to strangers and crashing back after his death, spouting conspiracy theories.
Aisling's fists were clenched, her nails digging into her palms. Maud shook her head.
I never abandoned Jack. I gave him up for his own good, and it broke my heart.
How could that be for his good? He'd just lost his mother. He loved you, Maud. How could his only sister abandoning him have made things better?
You don't understand. It was complicated. If I'd stayed... That's bullshit, Aisling hissed. It's complicated. It's what people say when it's not complicated at all. It's what people say when they're only thinking about themselves but don't want to look selfish.
Jesus, Maud said, your arrogance. You think you know everything and you know nothing.
I know enough. I know that this bloody quest of yours is about you, not about Jack. You're trying to redeem yourself, trying to make up for all the years you wasted.
Well, you can't do that, Maud. There's no going back, and nothing you do, nothing I do, will change the fact that Jack is dead.
Maud looked stricken. She opened her mouth to speak, but nothing came out. Aisling felt a pang of regret that was something like grief.
I don't know what you expect from me, Maud.
She'd meant it as an apology, but she was still angry and it came out like an accusation. Maud shook her head slowly.
I don't expect anything from you, Aisling, she said. I don't expect anything from anyone. Maybe that's the difference between us.
She moved to stand, but as she did so, someone placed a firm hand on her shoulder. A woman with spiky blonde hair and a serious expression on her face. She wasn't alone. A man lurked over the woman's left shoulder. Aisling didn't need to look at the ID the woman held out to know they were police.
Maud Blake, I'm Detective Sergeant Hackett.
She put the badge into her back pocket, not removing her hand from Maud's shoulder.
You're under arrest for the murder of Hilaria Blake on the night of the 21st of February, 1993. You're not obliged to say anything, but whatever you say will be taken down in writing and may be given in evidence.
Maud had flinched when the detective took hold of her shoulder and gave the ID held out to her only a cursory glance. Now her eyes held Aisling's pleading. Pleading, but for what? They were, all four of them, frozen for a moment in time, Maud half-standing, Hackett's hand still on her shoulder, the unnamed Gartha, and Aisling still sitting at the table, her coke untouched. Then movement started again, as if someone had pressed play on a video. Hackett reached down and took Maud's handbag, which was slung on the back of her chair. As Hackett turned to hand it to the other Gartha, Maud turned too, taking a step towards them. She stumbled, recovered, and in that stumble, her foot pushed her backpack under the table until it rested, heavy, against Aisling's foot. Aisling stared, but Maud didn't look at her again. The Gardaí walked her out of the pub, keeping her between them, tiny and vulnerable. Chapter 21. Melanie Hackett was perfectly civil. Maud sat in the back of the Garda car for the short drive to Mill Street and shoved her hands between her knees to keep them from shaking. How much danger was she in? Her mother had been dead for 20 years, and her death had never been looked at as anything other than an accidental overdose. Nobody kept secrets in the village in 1993. If they'd suspected murder back then, Tom would have heard, and therefore so would she. Maud racked her brains, trying to think of something, any reason the Gardaí would have to suddenly suspect her of this crime. When they got to the interview room, Hackett busied herself setting up the tapes, but the male police officer sat still as a snake in his chair, silently watching Maud. If he was trying to intimidate her, he could fuck right off. Maud raised her chin and stared back into his eyes. Hackett pressed a switch and spoke for the benefit of the tape. "Maud Blake. You have been arrested under Section 30 of the Offences Against the State Act, 1939. You are not obliged to say anything unless you wish to do so, but whatever you say will be taken down in writing and may be given in evidence. Do you understand?" Maud assented, quietly, and Hackett nodded. "Present in the interview room are DS Melanie Hackett and Garda Daniel McIntyre." "Can I get you a coffee or tea, glass of water?" Hackett asked. Maud shook her head. Thought of all the cop shows she'd seen where police got DNA from a coffee cup. But DNA was hardly an issue here, surely. And anyway, she'd been arrested. Couldn't they compel her to give a sample? She had no idea. Something to ask a lawyer, if she had one. She would ask for a lawyer. She should call Tom, but not yet. Not until she knew more. "I'd like to ask you some questions about your mother's death," Hackett said.
"My mother," Maud said.
Hackett waited.
"My mother died 20 years ago. She was an alcoholic. She died from a drug overdose, though she was dying in any case, and I expect that the drugs only brought her death forward by a few months, if that. I've no idea why anyone would think that I killed her."
"Perhaps you'd like to tell me in your own words how your mother died."
"I'm sure you have the coroner's report."
Hackett inclined her head. "I do, but I'd like to hear about it from you." Maud hesitated.
"I wasn't in the room when she died," she said at last.
"Tell me what you do remember."
"It was 20 years ago. I was very young."
"You were 15. This from McIntyre.
"I remember quite a bit from when I was 15, Hackett said. "Mostly things I'd rather forget." "I don't remember anything because, as far as I recall, that night was the same as every other night. Nothing strange happened, nothing out of the ordinary. I didn't even realize my mother had died until the following morning."
Hackett shifted her weight in her chair, turned a page in the file she had in front of her.
"Describe an ordinary night in your home for us, so," she said. She spoke so casually, just a chilled-out conversation between friends.
Maud shrugged.
"I had a job, milking at a dairy farm down the road, some cleaning in their kitchen. I'd work until 2, then I'd walk into the village and pick Jack up, walk him home. I'd make him dinner, make dinner for Mother. We'd play or read for a while, then I'd get him ready for bed."
"What about your mother?" asked McIntyre. "She didn't look after you or your little brother?"
Maud shook her head. "My mother wasn't well. You would have cared for us if you'd been able."
Maud caught a flash of amusement in McIntyre's eyes as she spoke.
Did you bring dinner to your mother on the evening she died? Hackett asked.
I suppose I must have. I don't remember specifically, but I did that every night, so I suppose I must have done.
It sounds like you had a lot of responsibility for someone so young. You didn't resent it, that your mother left so much for you to do?
McIntyre asked. Maud shook her head, said nothing. He was making her uncomfortable. There was something behind his eyes, something in the way he looked at her. Her mouth was dry and she swallowed, realized she had shifted her weight backwards in her chair, an unsuccessful effort to put distance between them.
Did you talk to your mother that night?
Hackett asked.
I don't remember. I'm sorry.
What would you have done on a standard night? Did you sit with her while she ate? Did you talk? Maud shrugged again.
I mostly just gave her dinner, then went down to Jack.
No conversation?
My mother was very sick. She slept all the time. When she was awake, she was confused. We didn't chat.
Maud said.
Shouldn't she have been in a hospital, getting medical care?
Hackett's voice was gentle, oh, so sincere.
I tried, more than once. She wouldn't go, and the couple of times I got her there, she wouldn't stay.
Maud closed her eyes for a moment, opened them again.
Looking back as an adult, I can see things more clearly. My mother made it very clear, though, that she didn't want medical treatment. The last time she was in hospital, she signed a DNR, then called a cab to bring her home.
With no money to pay for it, all the way from Castle Bar. The cabbie had lost his shit, screaming and roaring at Maud, Hilaria having already disappeared inside the house. Until Jack came out and took Maud's hand protectively. The cabbie had looked at Jack, with his badly cut hair, his little boy chest out, but his lower lip wobbling, then looked at Maud. Then at the house behind them, with its boarded-up windows and leaking gutters. He'd uttered one last fuck and left.
I think my mother had had enough. She was in a lot of pain. The doctors had told her she didn't have much time left. I think she was ready to die.
Are you suggesting she committed suicide?
McIntyre asked.
No, just that... It might have been a release, said Maud.
McIntyre smiled at her.
Have you been telling yourself that for all these years?
Maud could see, though she thought that Hackett did not, that McIntyre was entertained by the situation. He took pleasure in her interrogation, in the prompting of her painful memories, in an idle sort of way. With that recognition, she realized why she was afraid of him. She had known someone like him once, when she was young.
Tell me about finding her body, Hackett said, before Maud had a chance to respond. It was the next morning, Maud said. I went into her room to see her before I brought Jack to school. It was still dark, but I had a candle. She was lying on the bed, but she didn't move when I called her. When I got close enough, I realized why.
Maud could almost feel the cold clamminess of her mother's forehead, as it had felt that morning when she'd finally been brave enough to reach out and touch her.
How did you know? Hackett asked. You said it was obvious. How did you know she was dead?
I touched her, and her skin was cold. There was blood at the corners of her mouth. Her eyes were open, but they weren't right. And she had a shoelace tied around her arm. There was a needle still in her arm. I pulled it out.
What did you do next?
I left the room. I found my brother and I brought him to school. Then I went to the post office and used the payphone to call the police.
And then?
I waited.
You didn't tell anyone else? Didn't call a family friend or a relative?
Hackett asked. Maud looked at her blankly. They'd had no relatives, no family friends. Wasn't that obvious?
You just went back to the house and waited there by yourself?
Maud nodded.
Your mother was dead upstairs? You weren't afraid?
Maud laughed despite herself.
It's not the date you need to be afraid of.
What were you afraid of, Maud?
Hackett was smooth. She got the tone just right. A perfect mix of sympathy and solidarity.
Maud shook her head, said nothing, reminded herself to be careful.
Hackett wasn't stupid. And McIntyre?
He was something else.
Hackett turned some pages in her file, appeared to check something. When Garda Riley came to the house that night, you were alone with your little brother. You went back to the school to collect him.
Maud nodded again.
And you told no one at his school, not a teacher, not one of the mothers, that your own mother was dead at home.
This from McIntyre, a statement rather than a question.
No.
You weren't upset. I suppose no one could blame you.
I think I was in shock.
He waited, but she said nothing more.
Your brother was hurt?
He had bruises, Hackett said.
Yes.
On examination at hospital, he was found to have a fracture to his right arm and a number of other injuries. Fractured ribs partially healed. A healed fracture to his left arm. Some burn scars.
Maud said nothing, but memories came flooding back. Memories of pain, of desperate worry. Memories of a small and trusting hand in hers.
Did your mother hurt him, Maud?
Hackett asked quietly.
Maud shook her head, said nothing.
She hurt Jack and she hurt you, didn't she?
That's why you had to kill her, to make the beatings stop.
Maud met Hackett's gaze straight on.
My mother never hit me in her life. Never hit Jack. It's not the way she was made. She was an alcoholic. She made a lot of mistakes. But she never once raised a hand to us.
Hackett put her hand on a manila file sitting on the table in front of her.
A colleague recently interviewed a social worker who was involved in your case. She was very clear that you and your brother were afraid of your mother. It was her view that you were both physically abused by your mother.
You're telling me that she got it wrong?
Maud shook her head. Our mother never hurt us.
So your brother's injuries were all accidents? He just tripped and fell on cigarettes, did he? More than once?
There was sudden fury in McIntyre's voice, as if Maud's composure was an insult. His abrupt change in demeanor was disconcerting.
Maud didn't answer. She turned her attention to Hackett and waited.
Hackett opened her mouth to speak, but was interrupted by McIntyre.
Detective Sergeant Cormac Riley. You know him?
Hackett stirred uneasily at the question, looked at the tape recorder.
I'm sorry? Maud asked.
Cormac Riley, the Garda who came to your house the night your mother died. You met with him earlier this week. He visited you in your hotel room.
What? McIntyre's expression was bland again. The fury dissipated as quickly as it had arrived. His face gave nothing away.
No. I haven't seen Garda Riley in 20 years.
And somehow that simple truth sounded more like a lie than anything else.
Maud glanced towards Hackett, who gave McIntyre a look of her own.
Let's get back on track, Hackett said.
Were you taken into care?
No.
Your brother's injuries were very severe. If he had been beaten that badly in the past, it seems strange that he was not put into care.
Maud said nothing, waited for the question. She wanted to bring the interview to an end, but she still didn't know why she'd been brought here.
Hackett paused, turned a page in the file. She seemed to have lost her sense of direction.
Blake?
Not a particularly Irish name.
My mother's family were Anglo-Irish.
Wealthy? McIntyre asked.
At one time, certainly.
What happened? Hackett asked.
An old story. I come from a long line of alcoholics and wastrels. By the time my mother was born, the money was gone, except for a small trust fund.
Your mother didn't work?
She taught English. She was a writer. When I was born in 1978, my mother wasn't married. After that, she couldn't get teaching jobs. By the time Jack was born, the money had run out. Not long after that, we moved to Galway. The house was an old family house.
I don't even know if my mother owned it. Probably the land and house had long since been sold, but as the house was abandoned, my mother just reclaimed it.
No other family?
No. And your mother was an alcoholic?
Yes.
And a drug addict?
Maud shrugged.
Danny broke in, his voice unnecessarily loud.
The coroner's report showed no evidence of previous drug use.
I never knew her to use drugs.
Maud turned her gaze from Hackett to Danny.
I didn't say she was a drug addict.
You didn't say she wasn't,
McIntyre said, then glanced at Hackett.
She didn't use drugs?
Hackett asked.
Other than alcohol, not that I was aware of.
Other than the day she died.
McIntyre's tone was an accusation. Maud said nothing. She stared into Hackett's eyes. They were a cool, calm blue.
There was no ally to be found there.
Where do you think she got the heroin?
Hackett asked.
I don't know.
She had friends? People who visited the house?
Maud shifted slightly in her chair. She checked her watch.
Well, yes, of sorts.
Of sorts? Said Hackett. Where did they meet?
I don't know.
Can you recall their names?
I'm afraid not.
Maud took a breath.
Look, I've answered all your questions, though this whole thing is bloody ridiculous, and I have a question I'd like to ask now.
Hackett raised an eyebrow, waited.
My brother, Jack, your investigation into his death. I've been asking questions since I got to Galway and no one is answering them. I've given you proof that Jack didn't kill himself as you say he did, and you've done nothing. I've made a formal complaint, requested that the investigation be reopened. A week later, and it seems you have done nothing at all to find my brother's murderer, but you are instead focusing on the death of my mother, a death that took place 20 years ago, and for no reason at all that I can see, you've chosen to lay at my door.
At the risk of sounding cliched, Maud, I have to remind you that we are the ones who ask the questions, although you haven't asked a question yet.
What I want to know is what all of this has to do with my brother's death. I want to know if you are ever going to investigate his murder, and if not, why not?
Mel Hackett shook her head slowly.
We're not here to talk about your brother's death, she said.
Although perhaps we should be,
McIntyre said.
His gaze was almost feverish now. The implication of his statement was obvious. There it was.
I'd like to see my solicitor now,
Maud said.
Chapter 22. It was 8:30 before Cormac reached the station. The car park was almost empty, but he recognized Hackett's little red hatchback. He asked himself what he would do if she and Danny were still interviewing Maud Blake. Interrupt? Take the interview over? Just observe and let them fuck it up?
Cormac forced himself to walk up the stairs, instead of taking them three at a time and at speed, which is what he really wanted to do. He wanted to burst into the squad room to rant and rage at whoever was present. Instead, he compressed his rage into a white-hot ball and told himself he would use it as fuel. The squad room was quiet. No sign of Danny, but Melanie Hackett was working at her desk. He replayed everything he knew about her. She was short, no more than 5'5", spiky blonde hair intended to convey
something.
He'd heard she was ambitious.
That was it?
Fuck. He stood over her.
What is it that you think you're doing?
Cormac asked, very calmly. She looked up, took off her glasses, pushed her chair away, putting a little distance between them.
I'm doing my job, detective.
How about you? I'm certainly doing my job, Detective Hackett. In fact, I was interviewing a witness this afternoon at the same time, as I understand it, that you were arresting my suspect. Where is she?
He asked.
In the cells.
There was a little pink in her cheeks now, but she was otherwise admirably cool.
So you've charged her?
It wasn't a question, but Hackett nodded.
On what evidence?
For a moment it seemed as if she wasn't going to answer him. On the strength of Hannah Collins' statement,
she said. Cormac gave a grim smile. So you got nothing out of the interview, because you went in completely unprepared. 20-year-old case, no forensics, no motive, and of the three people who were in the house that night, two were dead. But you think you're going to get the DPP to bring this to court, based on the word of a junkie who wants to get out of prison? A junkie with a history of providing inaccurate information to the Gardaí. She stared back at him, poker face intact. I don't arrest suspects where there's no evidence, Mel. Do you know why? Because if I arrest someone, they're going to jail. That's the way it works. I take them in when I've got them. This is not a drugs case. This is a murder. And you have just fucked up. Royally.
Melanie glanced around the room. There was only one guard there within hearing distance, a uniform who was keeping his attention on his computer screen. She turned away from him, back to her own computer, and put a hand on her mouse, signaling an end to their conversation.
Not happening.
Cormac grabbed the closest empty chair and pulled it towards him, then sat facing her, a little too close for comfort.
He leaned in. I want to know if this is how you do business here, because it sure as hell isn't how we work in Dublin. This is my case. I was interviewing a witness when another detective, not even on murder, arrests my suspect without my consent, without even as much as a phone call. Where I come from, that would be a firing offence, except it would never fucking happen, because no self-respecting detective would ever do it. So my question is this. Are you incompetent? Do you want to get fired? Or is something else going on here?
She turned her face to him. Listen, Murphy ordered it, all right? You were not getting the job done for reasons I'm not going to speculate about. She looked him up and down. You have a problem? Take it up with Murphy. She turned again to her computer.
Jesus Christ. Had Murphy decided to pull the case? It was less than a day since their last meeting. Maybe I'll do that, Cormac said.
He pushed his chair back.
You won't get him now,
Hackett said to her computer screen. He left for Dublin this afternoon. Won't be back until Tuesday.
Melanie.
He put conciliation in his voice, waited until she turned to face him again.
What changed? I left Murphy's office yesterday just before lunch and I was the lead on this case. 24 hours later, he leaves for Dublin, but not before he puts the case in your hands. No phone call, no notice to me. What am I missing?
He watched her try to take his measure. When she spoke, her expression was unsympathetic.
Look, I didn't speak to Murphy, but I think his reasons are obvious. You know what I'm talking about. You think I slept with Maud Blake?
She shrugged.
I'm not sleeping with her, Mel. I shouldn't have to say this. I'm in a long-term relationship with a woman I love, but even if I wasn't, I wouldn't sleep with a key suspect in a murder case.
His tone was matter-of-fact and seemed to hold her attention.
It's a bullshit rumor, and I'd like to know where you heard it.
He could see her think about telling him, then decide against it, but she was listening. It was a start. I've heard you have history. Maud Blake wouldn't be the first, she said.
That's bullshit, too.
He could have said more, could have explained that his relationship with Emma began after she had been cleared, after the case was closed. That his superiors in Dublin knew about it as soon as they started dating. But fuck her.
Maud denied killing her mother.
Yes.
Did she mention anything about a neighbor, a Miss Keane, or a Simon Schmidt?
Hackett shook her head.
Okay.
He stood up, started to walk away, then turned back as something occurred to him.
If you didn't speak to Murphy, who did?
She hesitated, then shrugged. Daniel McIntyre. He stared at her.
Danny McIntyre told you that Murphy wanted you to arrest Maud Blake.
Yes. Danny again. And again no call to give him a heads up. Cormac looked around.
Where is he?
He's gone. For a moment it looked like she wasn't going to say any more. Then she relented. Danny went home to his parents last night. I think he's going to take some time off. It was an explanation of sorts. Giving Cormac a heads up would hardly have been a priority for him under the circumstances, but Cormac had the strongest feeling that with Danny, it wasn't that simple. The bail hearing's on Monday, Hackett was saying, in the morning,
I'm working on the file now if you have anything you want to add. But it was her arrest, her file, her cock-up to defend. She wasn't his enemy, but they weren't on the same side either, and whatever else happened, he wasn't going to stand over this arrest. Cormac left the squad room. He made for the exit. It was hard to believe that he'd only had the case for 5 days. 2 days ago, he'd interviewed Catherine Shelley and felt he had a handle on it. How had he lost control so completely? Where could he go with things from here? For the moment, at least, he had no idea. He shoved his hands into his pockets and made for home. He didn't get far. Carrie O'Halloran was coming up the stairs, stripping off a high-vis jacket and looking exhausted. They saw each other at the same time and stopped.
It's official now, Carrie said. Danny's finally caved. Search parties are out, near his parents' place in Ballintubber. Only 2 fucking weeks too late.
Search called off for the night? He asked.
No. Now that the family has finally copped on, they've gone into overdrive. All the neighbors are out with torches, people from the school.
You're not with them, he said, just as something to say.
His mind was already half gone from the moment, beginning to worry again about his own problems.
I'm working something else. A domestic violence case. Wife denies the abuse, though it's been reported more than once by others. They have 2 young children.
Her tone caught his attention. Her tiredness was less evident as she focused on him, and her expression sharpened. She had something to tell him. He could feel it. She was trying to decide if he was trustworthy, if telling him whatever was on her mind would help or hinder her. He opened his mouth to speak, and her phone rang, loud in the echoing quiet of the stairwell. She answered the phone, listened for a moment.
Where?
She asked. Then she turned on her heel and was gone. Chapter 23. It had definitely been deliberate. That slight stumble of Maud's that pushed the backpack under the shadow of the table. Aisling felt its weight against her ankle. She kept absolutely still, as if moving a muscle would bring the Gardaí back. People were turning to look at her as the story spread through the pub to those who had missed the action. The noisy buzz had dropped to an unnatural hush, and now it picked up and redoubled. Aisling stood. Then, as casually as she could manage, she picked up the backpack and slung it over her shoulder. She took a drink from her glass, but nervousness made her hasty and she ended up coughing. She left the rest behind and walked from the pub. Sleet was coming down sideways. She zipped her jacket against the cold, took her hat from her pocket, and pulled it low over her forehead and ears. She turned her face to the wind and rain and walked down Quay Street, crossing the Wolfetone Bridge, where the river started to widen before it emptied into the sea. The wind buffeted her, and the rain turned to icy needles on her face. But she welcomed it. She wanted to lift her head to the sky and scream out her frustration, her anger, and her loss. Instead, calm, ever outwardly calm, she made her way home, let herself into the house, and put the kettle on for tea. She leaned against the counter, head resting on her hands, listening to the whistle of the kettle on its way to boiling. Then she took a mug from its stand on the counter, turned, and threw it as hard as she could against the wall.
Fuck! Fuck, fuck, fuck!
She put her face in her hands, closed her eyes, felt the thunder of her pulse in her ears. Then she took out her phone, called Mary Dooley, and asked her to let the hospital know that she would not be in the next day. She was taking some time off. Sorry for the lack of notice, but she needed at least a week. She cut short Mary's expression of concern and support, ended the call, then went to put on a fire in the living room. She showered, a blessedly long, hot shower that leached her pain and distress away, and dressed again in pajamas and an old jumper of Jack's. Finally, she gathered the backpack, a bottle of wine, an open packet of supermarket hummus, and the end of a loaf of bread, and settled herself into the living room couch. The room was lit only by the flickering of the firelight, and she switched on a reading lamp. She poured herself a glass of wine, took a drink, then rested her head against the couch and closed her eyes. She let everything stop. Jack's death, Maud's quest for vengeance or answers or forgiveness. The constant brutal competition she engaged in at her job. The pregnancy. Everything. She sat very quietly for 5 everlasting minutes. Then she turned and picked up the backpack. It was new. A plain navy canvas bag with a separate cushioned section to protect the newish-looking laptop that sat inside. She took that out first and turned it on, but it was password-protected. Besides the computer, there was an A4-lined notebook with additional loose-printed pages tucked inside. Aisling opened the notebook and started to read through Maud's notes. The handwriting was a soft, rounded cursive. Maud had written out everything that had happened, what little she had discovered, and a range of possible theories, all in a tidy blue ink that made the whole thing look like a child's project. Aisling turned the pages slowly, reading the notes with deliberation. Was this the work of someone obsessed? The work of a sister overcome with guilt and looking for someone to blame? Or was it the work of someone who simply loved her brother, albeit from a distance of years and kilometers, believed with good reason that he had been killed, and desperately wanted justice for him? Aisling turned another page and came across the stub of a boarding card for a flight from Perth to Dublin and 2 photographs that had been tucked inside the notebook. The date on the card was Tuesday, the 12th of March. Aisling looked at it for a moment, feeling unsettled. She'd assumed that Maud had booked her flight to Ireland on hearing of Jack's death. Now it seemed she'd come back earlier. Aisling tried to remember if she had ever spoken to Maud about her return to Ireland, and couldn't. She set the boarding card down and picked up the photographs. They were dog-eared and dirty. The first showed a girl, maybe 12 or so, with a baby sitting on her lap. The girl was smiling. The baby, rounded and sandy-haired, cuddled protectively in her arms. The other photograph showed the same girl, but older now, and the little boy was standing beside her, holding her hand. In this one, neither of them smiled, but stared back at the camera with a sort of blank distrust that Aisling found disturbing. Aisling drank from her wine glass, then took the photographs and sat back on the couch. She crossed her legs and held the photographs out on her knees. Jack and Maud. Maud and Jack. It felt like she was prying, getting a glimpse into a life Jack himself had not remembered. The face of the little boy in the second photograph was haunting. Surely that child carried within him memories enough to scar him for the rest of his life. Looking at the photograph, at the lost look in his eyes, at the clasp of their hands, she wondered what the children had lived through. Could Jack have remembered more than he pretended? Maybe he carried the scars of those years in his subconscious. She put the photographs away, tucking them back into the notebook, and turning a page so she could no longer see them. Christ, Maud was probably being questioned right now. Could she have done it? Jack had been told that his mother died from a heroin overdose. It was hard to see how the Gardaí could have changed their minds about that. Hilaria was dead 20 years. It wasn't as if new forensic evidence could have suddenly come to light. And if she had died from a heroin overdose, it was hard to see how a 15-year-old girl could be held accountable for it. The whole thing seemed far-fetched. On the other hand, she'd had motive enough. And if she was guilty, it would explain why she was so wary of police. Aisling lay back on the couch, the notebook held to her chest in an unconscious embrace. Her mind clear of distraction and distress for the first time in weeks, she considered. She did not believe that Jack had killed himself. On the other hand, she found it hard to believe he had been murdered. So, perhaps an accident? Maybe even an accident involving a friend who had panicked and in guilt and fear made a stupid phone call to try to hide the truth. Did she need answers? Did she need every specific about how and why Jack had died? No. She believed now that Jack had not killed himself, and that was enough. She wished she could leave it at that. Maud was so fearless. Aisling didn't know if she wanted to know the details, to know if Jack had suffered, been afraid, before he died. She didn't know if she could carry that pain, too, with all the rest. But Maud had been right about something. She owed Jack more than the turning of her cheek. She owed him her best attempt at getting to the truth. What could she do? What was within her reach? She'd gotten the post-mortem report, and that hadn't helped. She hadn't done anything about his phone messages, and she would have to wait until Monday to do anything about it now. She could call the police, find out if they had traced any of Jack's calls that day. Rogers wasn't the only guard in Galway. Riley. Could she trust him? Maybe. If she talked to him properly this time, would the CCTV and the post-mortem report be enough to prompt him to get a warrant for the phone records if Rogers hadn't already done it? Her phone buzzed, and a long apologetic text came in from Mary. She was really sorry, but Cummins had requested a formal handover of her patients before Aisling could take leave. Could she come in on Sunday evening? Cummins would meet her at 8 p.m. on the ward. Aisling sent back a quick yes, and tried not to think about how Cummins and the other consultants might react to her sudden absence. Aisling rubbed at her eyes. If someone had contacted Jack, had asked to meet that day, it would have been by phone or email. Jack didn't use social media, or at least none of the big platforms. She took a second sip of wine, then pulled her own laptop over from the coffee table. She knew Jack's email password. She could start there. A moment later, and she was skimming through 70 unopened emails. She didn't need to click on any of them. They were promotional, mostly, one or two from friends sent in the first few days after his death, before the story got around. The little blue new boxes started to disappear from beside the emails, and she felt a wave of grief that Jack would never see these messages. Then she felt an equally strong sense of the ridiculous and hiccuped out something resembling a laugh. Jack wouldn't be too bothered about missing a buy one get one free coupon from the pizzeria down the street. God, this felt weird. There were a lot of emails from hiking friends. Someone had sent a group photograph from their last trip, and everyone had replied with a comment or a joke. A couple of iTunes receipts. A few new LinkedIn requests. Nothing much else. Nothing helpful. She rested her fingers on the keyboard and looked at the neat list of emails on the screen. Something was nagging at her. She didn't use Gmail herself and had been glad of it recently because of something Mary had told her about a friend who'd used her boyfriend's Gmail account to figure out that he had not, in fact, stopped seeing his ex, but was going around to hers for a shag every Friday like clockwork when Mary's friend worked a late shift. The cheating boyfriend had been so careful, no emails, no text messages. Because he'd cheated before and been caught, he'd taken to leaving his phone out where his girlfriend could look at it whenever she wanted, even shared his email password. But the girlfriend had managed to catch him anyway, by tracing his phone. Aisling picked up her phone and dialed Mary's number. It rang 6 times before she answered, and then it was with the roar of music in the background. She'd obviously finished work for the day. "Hang on," Mary said as she took herself to a quieter spot. Then, "Aisling, you all right? Do you need me to come round?" "That friend of yours, the one with the shitty boyfriend, how did she trace his phone?" Mary was silent for a moment, but she didn't ask any questions. That was good. Aisling couldn't have answered them. "He had a Google account, Gmail. He used Gmail on his phone. Didn't realize that when he put his email account on his phone, he accepted all sorts of shit. Google keep a record of everywhere you go, how long you spend there. They keep it for, like, years. He gave her his email password to prove how straight down the line he was. Didn't realize that all she had to do was click on timeline and she could see exactly how often and how long he was spending at his ex's place." "Timeline? Yep. Okay. Thanks. Aisling, what's going on? Are you saying, was Jack cheating on you?" The thought had honestly never occurred to her. It did then, just for a moment, before she dismissed it. "Not Jack," she said. "Not his style." She got off the phone by promising to call Mary the next day, hung up, and turned back to her laptop and Jack's email account. Chapter 24. Hackett had ended the interview as soon as Maud asked for a lawyer and brought her straight down to the holding cells. The custody sergeant took her details, her handbag, the contents of her pockets. His matter-of-factness was reassuring, but maybe it shouldn't have been.
The place smelled strongly of disinfectant. Someone in a cell was singing rebel songs, tunefully enough, although he kept losing his place and starting again. She was put in a cell by herself, and told that she would be brought to Limerick Prison in the morning until her bail hearing, which would be on Monday. She asked again for her lawyer and was told he'd been called. Then the cell door was closed and she was alone. Maud was grateful, at least, that she had that privilege. She sat on the bunk. The sheets were clean. Lights were turned down low, but then it was late now, wasn't it? She'd met Aisling at about 6 o'clock. Maud lay down and closed her eyes. She could pretend to be somewhere else, while she waited and thought. In her hotel room, or better yet, back on the station in the Kimberley, before it had been sold. No cicadas, but she'd heard Nancy Spain sung there too, more than once. She might have drifted off. She was woken by the custody sergeant, who opened the door without warning or ceremony.
"Your solicitor's here,"
the sergeant said. He'd spilled something on his uniform. A dark splodge that might have been ketchup stained his trousers right up near his crotch. His eyes followed hers, then he frowned. She opened her mouth to explain, but he cut across her.
"I don't have all night."
He showed her to an interview room, then shut the door. She took a seat at the table, wondering at the fact that her hands were free. Probably the door was locked. She didn't check it. 5 minutes later it opened, and a man walked into the room. He was familiar, enough so that she felt a rush of emotion before she had an opportunity to process how she knew him. It was Tom, but so different now. And it wasn't just the width of his shoulders, the gray at his temples. The difference was in his manner, his self-possession. As he walked in, his eyes were on her, assessing, examining. He gave a friendly nod of dismissal to the guard and took a seat opposite her.
"Maud," he said.
Maud felt the distance between them, felt his caution. She couldn't miss his reserve, and it should have prompted her to be careful. But the smile came to her lips unbidden. She pressed her fingers to her lips, but the smile grew until it took over her face. It came from somewhere inside, from the part of her that was still a girl, and knew that Tom was her true friend. And perhaps it was fed by her adult self, too, which understood how rare and precious that sort of love is. Tears blurred her vision and she blinked them away.
"Maud,"
Tom said again, but this time was different. He reached out a hand to her and stroked a tear from her cheek.
"Don't cry."
But she caught her breath and fresh tears fell at the touch of his hand. The Tom she'd known would never have done that. He had hated to be touched. She caught his hand before he could take it away and squeezed it hard before releasing him.
"I'm so sorry about Jack," he said.
She nodded, scrubbed her cheeks dry with the sleeve of her cardigan. Tom found a folded tissue in his pocket and handed it to her.
"I tried to get in touch to let you know, but I couldn't reach you."
"The station is gone," Maud said. "Lawton died, and his son wanted to sail." The sail had broken her heart, had very nearly broken her. The station had been her refuge for 18 years. John Lawton had been her employer and her friend, but now, only a handful of months later, the loss of Jack had put the loss of her adopted home into perspective. The reason she'd had for staying away from Jack, even after he'd been safely adopted, seemed so stupid now. An attempt to put logic around her fear and her deep reluctance to ever return to Ireland. The trauma of her childhood and the loss of Jack had clung to her like a stain, and it had taken years to build a semblance of a life. She'd gone to London first, on the ferry, and spent 6 horrific, lonely, desperate months working in an East London pub shitty enough to turn a blind eye to the fact she was underage. When the opportunity came to go to Australia, opportunity in the form of a new job as a nanny for a wealthy family, she'd jumped at it. But caring for children had been too painful, and she'd moved on, taking one job after the other, until she'd ended up in the Kimberley, as camp cook on a remote station. The Kimberley was so different from home, it felt sometimes like she had been transported to another world.
For half of the year, the grass was bleached to a white straw that cracked and bristled under her feet. During the wet season, the rain came accompanied by violent thunder and lightning storms. The humidity was intense. The few bits of clothes she'd brought had rotted in the wardrobe. Life was a battle those first few years, a struggle she could throw herself into and forget about Ireland and Jack. By the time things got easier, she had fallen into a routine. It had been enough for her. She'd told herself it was all she wanted. But looking back now, it seemed like a scraping of a life. She'd been too afraid to want more.
"I'm sorry for that too," Tom said. "I wish you'd come sooner."
Then, grimacing,
"Maud, I'm sorry. I didn't mean..."
"I tried, but I was too late." They heard a distant shout, the sound of someone banging on a metal door. Tom took a deep breath.
"I can't be your lawyer. I came when I got your call, of course I did, but I can't represent you."
Maud hesitated. "Why?"
"Hannah is the reason you're in here."
"I don't understand." His eyes held hers.
"Hannah's in prison. She's been in prison for the best part of a year. She desperately wants to get out. She's given a statement to the Gardaí, Maud, about you."
Tom opened his briefcase, took out a file, tapped it with one finger.
"I think she's trying to make a deal. Information in exchange for early release."
"I see." Except she didn't really, and the pain of the blow surprised her. She hadn't seen Hannah for 20 years, but she would have laid odds that Hannah would never betray her.
"Her life hasn't been easy. I'm not making excuses. She made plenty of shitty decisions, and Hannah never met a drug she didn't like. But," he hesitated, "you know what Hannah was like. There was always a man, and every single one of them a bigger fucking asshole than the last."
He swallowed.
"I lost track of her a couple of years back. It wasn't the first time. She never wanted to see me when she was in bad shape. But then she called me, the Christmas before last. She asked to meet. I was so glad to hear from her, but afraid too. It had been more than 2 years by then. I'd looked for her, but..."
He shook his head.
"We met in Dublin, in a little cafe off St. Stephen's Green. She was very thin. Seemed very tired, but she was clean."
Maud waited, sure she was about to hear a story of an attempted recovery, followed by another relapse.
"She was pregnant, Maud. And she was so happy. She was determined to stay off drugs and give the baby a proper home. She came to live with me in Galway, kept getting treatment. There's a rehab place on Eglinton Street, day therapy, you know. But it was working for her. She stayed clean. She even got a job. Only 2 days a week in the local deli, but it was the first job she'd had in years. Her ex tried to get in touch, and she told him where to go. It was the pregnancy, I don't know. It just lit her up."
He stopped then, shook his head.
"What happened?"
Maud asked gently.
"They arrested her in June."
Tom's eyes hardened.
"Hannah's ex was a dealer. It happened before they broke up. He had Han call a guy, ask him over to their flat. When he got there, Hannah's ex beat the shit out of him, almost killed him. He owed him money over drugs. Hannah hadn't a clue, I swear, Maud. You know her. But they charged her with conspiracy to commit GBH. She got 3 years.
"Oh, shit, Tom. Shit."
"She didn't do it. She had no idea that the guy was in debt, had no idea what her ex had planned. But she's been in prison since June of last year."
"What about the baby?"
"Saoirse was born in July. Hannah's in Dorcas, the women's prison attached to Mountjoy. Women there are allowed to keep their babies until the baby turns one. Then the kids are taken away and put into care unless a relative steps forward."
"You?"
"Apparently not. It seems family services think that a single man who works full-time is not a suitable foster parent for a 1-year-old, even if he is her uncle. In 3 or 4 months, we're going to take Hannah's baby from her and put her into care."
Maud raised her hands, elbows still on the table, and pressed her fingers against her closed eyes. Anna's been going crazy. She can't give her baby up, Maud. If I was taking her, that would be one thing. But Hannah could never tolerate a stranger looking after her child. She knows firsthand how bad the system can be. She sees the whole thing starting again, just the way it was with us when Mam was sick. Maud opened her eyes and stared at him, willing him to tell her the rest.
Tom splayed an open hand across the file on the table.
I've told them I'm your lawyer. They gave me the file. There's a statement in there from Hannah. She says that you asked her for heroin, that she introduced you to Rick, and the next day your mother was dead.
And just like that, she was back in Ireland, 15 years old and hurrying as fast as she could to the secondary school, wanting to catch Tom before he reached it. She was wearing the old army surplus parka she'd bought in the charity shop. It was waterproof, but had a weird acrid smell, so she only wore it when the weather was really bad. She was hungry, but she'd dropped Jack to school with food in his belly and a full lunchbox, so it was a good morning. She hadn't seen Tom for a few weeks. She sat on the school wall and waited for him. At 15, it was legal for her not to attend school, so she ignored the looks of the few teachers who recognized her. She spotted Tom when he was half a mile away and jumped from the wall, hurrying towards him. He looked happy to see her, and despite everything, she felt a little less alone, a little comforted.
I need to talk to you, she said, and he followed her as she led the way back down the street.
What's the story? I have a maths test.
Come on, she said.
She turned into Main Street, knowing he would follow, then off it into a small park and the little playground that had been funded by the European Union. The sign with the big blue EU stars was almost as big as the slide. She sat on the bottom of the slide and started chewing a thumbnail. Tom stood for a moment, then slid his backpack from his back and took a seat on one of the swings, pushing idly into the sand with one foot.
So?
Miss Keane told Mother she thinks I should go back to school.
She didn't.
Tom looked confused.
Maud, that's brilliant. But then, who'd mind Jack after school? He finishes at 2, doesn't he?
Maud tasted a metallic tang in her mouth, took her thumb out, and wiped the welling blood on her jeans.
She's got a new friend, she said.
Tom looked confused.